So it's Father's Day, as you've heard, and because it's Father's Day, I get to tell my favorite joke, okay? This is the way my mind thinks. So, bro, don't try to read into it anything. This is just one of those jokes that I think is really funny. I don't care if you do or not, by the way. So there's this preacher who visited an elderly woman from his congregation, and he sat on the couch. He noticed a large bowl of peanuts on the coffee table. "Mind if I have a few?" he asked. "No, not at all," the woman replied. They chatted for a little while, and as the preacher stood to leave, he realized that instead of eating just a few peanuts, he had emptied most of the bowl. "I'm so sorry for eating all your peanuts," he said. "I really just meant to eat a few." "Oh, that's all right," replied the woman. "Ever since I lost my teeth, all I can do is suck the chocolate off them." That's a good joke? That's my favorite joke, yes. Sorry. Well, the interesting thing is that just about 3 years ago, I told that joke once before, and none of you remembered it. So that's the good news for me, is that I know now that every 2 or 3 years I can retell jokes, and it's okay, because you won't remember them, so it's good. But anyway, hopefully after you leave today, not the only thing you will remember is the joke, but there will be some other things in the service this morning also. We're going through the Gospel of Mark, as you know, and we're all the way up to chapter 3. But one of the things that I want to just say is that one of the things I try to do as we're going through a book of the Bible like Mark is keep reflecting on what we've talked about in the past, and then also a little bit about maybe where we're going. That when Mark wrote this gospel, he didn't just randomly pick a bunch of stories and just kind of throw them together, but that he thought about what he was doing, and as he put these stories together that were about Jesus, that he did it for a reason and a purpose, and he was telling a story about the gospel. Remember all the way back to chapter 1, verse 1, when he said, "This is the beginning of the gospel of Jesus Christ." And it seems to me, at least, that Mark's goal is that he's going to tell the beginning of the gospel, which is the life and the death and the resurrection of Jesus. But the end of the gospel is what it does in our lives and what it does for us, how we live out our following Jesus and our discipleship. And that's what Mark's goal is. I'm going to tell you the beginning, and then we're going to see how it works in your life and in the lives of those other people around you. And that's been going on for 2,000 years. That the gospel, if it only talks about Jesus and it doesn't come into our lives, then we're really wasting our time. The gospel has come to us, and what it does in our lives is important. As we've gone through so far, the interesting thing has been is that at the beginning, when Jesus started, we talked about some things about his life as they prepared for going into ministry and then his teaching. And what we've seen is, in chapter 1, essentially, there's kind of this overwhelming acceptance of Jesus. Most everybody who hears him thinks this is great. There's lots of good things about this guy. He's healing some people. Everything's good. In chapter 2, we start getting questions. Particularly the Pharisees, but also some teachers and some of the other people, they start asking questions. Well, Jesus, what about this? What about that? Now, we can take that as being something opposed to Jesus, but there's also an aspect of that that it's just people asking questions. We're trying to understand things a little bit better. And then last week, at the end of the first story of chapter 3, we have the Pharisees who are ready to kill Jesus. And so you see this progression of a general acceptance moving forward. Then as we get into chapter 3, now there's starting to be people who are in opposition to Jesus, even to the point where they're thinking about how to arrest him and to eventually kill him. They're already starting to do that, even though we're only in chapter 3. And what we're going to see today as we go into a few more stories in chapter 3 is that things are starting to become a little less clear about Jesus and his ministry and the way people respond to it. People are still excited about it, but there's starting to be some problems with the way that people are responding to Jesus. And that's you would think that somebody that was just preaching God's grace and love and he was healing people and casting out demons and doing all, you would think there would be sort of very limited opposition. But we're going to start seeing as we get into chapter 3 that that's not what happens. What happens is there starts to be problems. So in Mark chapter 3, we're going to start in verse 7. And this is the verse, just to remind you, that verse 6 says, "Then the Pharisees went out and began to plot with the Herodians how they might kill Jesus." Verse 7 then starts, "Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake, and a large crowd from Galilee followed. When they heard about all he was doing, many people came to him from Judea, Jerusalem, Idumea, and the regions across the Jordan and around Tyre and Sidon." So the crowds are coming, and apparently they're coming from all over the place. We'll look at a map in just a second because I failed to show you a map last week, so I have to show one this week because I can't go more than 2 weeks without a map. But the point is that these crowds are coming from all over to hear Jesus. Now we're going to see in a minute that this is actually going to cause some problems. Not that the crowds necessarily, the people are a problem, but that the crowds themselves are a problem. The other thing that we look at is this word withdrew. And there's a kind of a picture here of, does that mean that Jesus finds out the Pharisees and Herodians are plotting against him, so he leaves town and he gets out of there so they can't arrest him or anything? Or is Jesus just leaving the area because that was part of what he was doing? In the past, he's done that a couple of times where he's just left town because he needed to go someplace else or needed to go to another place. It's possible that what he's really trying to do is get away from the cities and get out in the country where maybe the crowds will thin out a little bit. As we're going to see, that seems to be a problem. I titled this service about this sermon about the craziness begins. And this is kind of the idea here. The crowds are going crazy for Jesus. And we know this even in our time. Something happens, and then all of a sudden it seems like everybody's talking about that thing, or everybody wants to follow that particular situation. And that seems to be what's going on with Jesus. He's the most popular game in town right now. Everybody's talking about Jesus. Everybody's coming to town to talk about or to see Jesus and to touch Jesus. And that picture then is creating more problems than it is anything else. So here's the map. And we talked about Israel. We're up here in Galilee. Right there is Capernaum. And there's the sea. So he went down from Capernaum to the lake, it says, somewhere in there. So when we talk about the areas that were here in verse 8, it starts with Judea, which is right here, and Jerusalem, which is right there. So that's the south from here. And then it says, and from Idumea and the regions across the Jordan. So here's the Jordan River. Idumea is down in this area. And then this is obviously the area of across the Jordan. Idumea is known in the Old Testament as Edom. Most people have heard of that if you've read some of the stories in the Old Testament. By the way, Herod is an Idumean. He is from Edom. And so when it talks about the Herodians back in chapter 6, you kind of get a little bit of a situation there. And then it says, and around Tyre and Sidon, which are way up here. There's Tyre. I can't see from the, is that Sidon way up there? So what you see then is, as Mark describes this, he says people are coming from all around. They're coming from the south, they're coming from the east, and they're coming from the north. They're not coming from the west because there's nobody out there. That's an ocean. That's what the blue represents, ocean out there. So you get the picture then that Jesus is saying, there's these people and they're coming from everywhere. They're coming from every direction, from all around. Everybody's hearing about Jesus, and that seems to be the picture that Mark is painting. And so Jesus is at the lake. In verse 9 it says, Because of the crowd, he told his disciples to have a small boat ready for him to keep the people from crowding him. For he had healed many, so that those with diseases were pushing forward to touch him. This idea of pushing forward, by the way, the word literally means they're falling on him. That's the picture. They're just, it's like the crowds are so pressing in that it's like he takes a step back and they all step forward, and he can't get away from them. They're just falling on him, which becomes important in a minute when we talk about somebody else who's falling down. But this falling forward means that Jesus can't even preach because there's so many people that they're falling down. And obviously these people don't have any, they're not worried at all about a virus or coronavirus or anything like that, because they're just so crowded in there. And there's all these people. It's so crowded that he has to get into a boat and go a little bit from the shore so he can talk to them. Otherwise, they would just be pressing on him and they would just be overwhelming him. That happens to me, by the way, all the time as a pastor. There's so many crowds, there's so many people that it's just, I can hardly get a word in because there's so much noise and so much. Now, it doesn't happen to me, but it happened to Jesus. And it does happen sometimes that this is kind of the downsides to the picture that we have here. Jesus gets a little frustrated, I think, this. So do the disciples with the crowds. And we're going to see that in other places because, for example, there's so many crowds that they have to feed them. And then Jesus divides up the bread and the fish. You remember that story. And we're going to see that story. And there's other stories like that, that the crowds create problems. Now, that's not necessarily, doesn't mean that the crowds are bad. It just means that we need to remember sometimes that even when good things happen, it creates problems. And that's what's going on here. It's getting crazy. Jesus' life is getting crazy. He can't even get by himself. In fact, we're going to read in a couple of minutes that the crowds are so bad that the disciples and Jesus can't even find a place to sit and eat. That's how bad it is. There are just so many people constantly coming, constantly going, trying to touch, trying to get a part of Jesus and all of those kinds of things. And so this report that we have then tells us that Jesus' life with his disciples right at this moment is pretty crazy. They can't get away from the crowds. And it doesn't appear either that the crowds are necessarily there because they want to hear what Jesus has to say. They're there because they're looking for either to see miracles or to be healed or to get something for themselves. So that seems to be the implication of this. A little bit changing the subject just slightly is verse 11, where it says, "Whenever the impure spirits saw him, they fell down before him and cried out, 'You are the Son of God.' But he gave them strict orders not to tell others about him." So along with the crowds falling on him, he also has the demons, the impure spirits, those who are possessed, also falling before him. So there's this constant, it's almost, instead of falling, we need to view that as kind of an avalanche type thing. It's just constantly pressing in on him. And the demons know exactly who Jesus is. "You are the Son of God." For reasons that we're not sure of, Jesus doesn't want people to listen to that. Now, it's probable that he doesn't want demons to be the primary witness of who he is. He'd rather people didn't listen to demons at all. It's also possible that that it's a matter of timing. What Jesus doesn't want is people jumping ahead. What he wants to do is show people who he is, and then after he dies and rises again, then we deal with who Jesus is. But right now, Jesus wants to control the narrative. That's what you hear today. That's what people want to do. They want to make sure that people are only hearing what they want to hear. Well, Jesus was one of those who started that. He wants to make sure that his voice is the one they hear and not others. He wants to make sure that things get out the way he needs to go. And the crowds are really causing a problem here. This is creating an issue. So the first lesson I have as we talk about this is that in the excitement of the moment, the gospel can be lost or misunderstood. And we forget that. Sometimes we get so excited about something that's going on that we lose track of Jesus. We lose track of the gospel. And all of a sudden we're starting to emphasize other things. There's this pastor who talks about the main thing. Have you heard about that guy? He's in town here. The main thing is to keep the main thing, right? Well, that's what the gospel is. It's the main thing. And that's what Jesus is trying to do. Keep the main thing. That's what he, but the crowds are making that difficult. And that sometimes happens to us. We get overwhelmed by the moment and we start getting off track. And so we need to keep focusing on who Jesus is and what he has called us to do. Now we have a contract. That's a contrast. This little story about the crowds is kind of this report. Mark tells us this is what's going on in Jesus' life. What does Jesus do at this point is he just keeps preaching, except that's not what he does. Look at verse 13. It says, now remember, at the beginning of the last section, it says that Jesus withdrew with his disciples to the lake. In verse 13, it says, Jesus went up on a mountainside and called to him those he wanted, and they came to him. What's Jesus doing? He's getting away from the crowds. And it says there that he's calling those he wanted to go with him, and they came. By the way, that's the situation we have with any time we talk about God choosing disciples or God calling people. It's God calls, and the ones he calls are the ones who come. And that's the, there's a both. There's God's calling, but there's also a response. How do we know who God calls? Well, the ones who respond to the call, we know. And so we focus on that with the disciples. It appears that what Jesus is doing is he's saying, I just want a smaller group of people. I want those people who are listening to my words to come with me out on the mountain. By the way, just one of those things generally about reading the Bible, whenever somebody goes up on a mountain, they're usually meeting God or about to experience something from God. So when it says mountainside, as a Bible reader, you're supposed to go, oh, perk up, something's going to happen here. And so, verse 14, it says, he appointed 12 that they might be with him and that he might send them out to preach and to have authority to drive out demons. So you see this picture then. The first line there about the that they might be with him, where was that at? Right there. They might be with him. Aren't the crowds with him? Well, they're near him, but they're not with him. Being with somebody is different than just being close to them. So you can have two people walking down the road, and just because they're walking near each other doesn't mean they're together. What's what Jesus is looking for? He's looking for people who want to be with him and that he wants to be with. That's an important part. Later on, that becomes a significant thing about the apostles. They keep going back to that idea. Those who are with him from the beginning, John says in his letter. And in other places, they'd say similar type things. It's so that he pulls together these disciples. He appoints 12 to be the leader. And 12 is an important number. You've heard the number 12 in the Bible before, haven't you? 12 tribes of Israel. Remember that part? So the reason why he chooses 12 is because there's a choosing a, I don't want to say a new people of God necessarily, but he's changing the way the people of God is organized. Rather than in family units and tribes, he's changing it to people in general who have leaders that are not family or because of their heredity, that puts them in a place of being a priest or a king. Instead, now it's going to be those who are appointed, those who are chosen. We use the word ordained a lot of times in the same situation. So that 12 represents a new people of God. In verse 16, he names them. These are the 12 he appointed: Simon, to whom he gave the name Peter, James, son of Zebedee, and his brother John. To them he gave the name Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Andrew, Philip, Bartholomew, Matthew, Thomas, James, son of Alphaeus, Thaddeus, Simon the Zealot, and Judas Iscariot, who betrayed him. There are several lists of the 12, and they're almost all exactly the same except for some towards the end, but there are certain things that are always true. Peter is always at the front. Judas is always at the end. And each section is usually the same. So it's always Peter, James and John, and Andrew, even though it's not necessarily in that order. Sometimes it's Peter and Andrew, then James and John. And then the next one after that is Philip, and he's always number five, leading off with Bartholomew, lost my place here, then Matthew and Thomas and James, son of Alphaeus, and then the last two there are known by different names. And that's kind of the thing that we're just going to take from this list right now is that it's interesting how many of these people have more than one name, and they're known by more than one name. Matthew, for example, is probably also the Levi that we read about a few weeks ago, about a tax collector. Apparently, he called James and John Boanerges, which means sons of thunder, which is what Mark says, but it's a little difficult to tell exactly what that does that mean. It could just mean that they were loud, boisterous people, but it could also mean that they were very angry people and very in-your-face kind of things. And then you have Simon, who is called Peter, the Rock. And you have all these nicknames from people, and several of the other ones are known by, like Simon towards the end, the Zealot. So we have these nicknames for people, and apparently Jesus is the one who gave them those names. Most of the time, there's no real explanation as to why. We're just told that that's what they did. And the interesting thing is that most of the time it's because they have a common name with somebody else. So Simon is called Peter. Why? Because there's another Simon called the Zealot. There's James, who's Boanerges. Why? Because there's another James, son of Alphaeus. So there's these same names, and so that's why they give them different names. Just as an aside, there's also a lot of Greek and Hebrew things going on. Peter is a Greek name. Simon is a Jewish name. Peter or Philip and Andrew are Greek names. Matthew and Simon are Hebrew names. So there's probably some of that going on too. Well, later on, when we read about Paul is a Greek name. His Hebrew name is Saul. His full name was probably, if we said it in Latin, Saulus Paulus. That was his name. At first, he was called Saul because he was living in a Jewish situation, but after he became a Christian, we started calling him Paul because it was more of a Gentile name, and Paul was the apostle to the Gentiles, and that's why he went by his second name. Aren't you glad you came just to hear that? No, you're saying, just get on with it, Pastor. Get done with this and get on to the next thing. So we have these 12 that God chose to be leaders in the church. And there are certain things that they were supposed to be with him. He was going to send them out to preach, and they were going to cast out demons. That's what Jesus says about these apostles. I guess it's really interesting to me is that we know about Peter, and we hear some things about John, and in some of the other Gospels, Andrew's mentioned a couple times, and Philip. We get to the book of Acts, and all these guys kind of disappear. We don't hear about them at all. I'm of the opinion, and this is totally my opinion, you don't have to believe it or not, but I believe that after the resurrection, and after they spent a few months kind of going with the other apostles and doing things, I'm of the opinion that most of the apostles left. They took Jesus literally and they went into the world. And the reason we don't hear about them is because, like the tradition is that Thomas went to India. Matthew went down to South Africa someplace, and some of the other ones went to, so we just don't hear about them anymore because they left town. They took Jesus literally, and they went into the world to preach the gospel. That's what they did. And they didn't worry about writing that stuff down because they were just intent on getting people to hear about Jesus. That's all that mattered. Again, you don't have to believe that. I'm not going to write a book and insist that everybody believe me or anything like that. I'm just saying that that's what's going on with. I think that's what happened with the disciples. That's why there are 12, but we don't really hear about most of them in the New Testament. See, again, aren't you glad you came today? Just to hear that. Just to hear these little nuggets of wisdom and these little descriptions. And anyway, we'll see. So we got the 12. Now, this is the difference between the crowds and what Jesus wants from those who are following him. Not just those who are trailing after him and are looking for a miracle or something, but true disciples. What's the difference between the crowd and the disciples? So here it is. First of all, the crowd say, "Isn't this exciting?" And Jesus says, "Yes, but I want you to be with me." The crowd say, "Isn't this exciting?" And Jesus says, "Yes, but I want you to preach this to others, not just listen to me, but take the message out." The crowd say, "Isn't this exciting?" And Jesus says, "Yeah, but I want you to be able to fight spiritual battles, cast out demons, to deal with the spiritual things that are going on there." And I think this is the difference between those that went up on the mountainside with Jesus and those down at the lake. Those down at the lake are looking for excitement. They're looking for the next best thing. They're not looking for things to happen. And Jesus goes off by himself and calls his disciples and says, "Okay, you're going to be with me. We're going to learn together. And then we're going to take what we learn and we're going to share that with other people. And we're going to realize that we're in the midst of a spiritual battle, a spiritual warfare. Things are going to happen that there's going to be a war. And you have to be ready for that. We're going to see what that war is coming up really quick, like in the next couple of verses. There's going to be spiritual issues that we're going to have to deal with. And if you're just part of the crowd, one, you're not going to be really with Jesus. You're not really going to be ready to preach to other people, and you're not really going to be ready to fight these spiritual battles. And that's why Jesus goes off by himself with his disciples to teach them and to guide them and to help them. That's what Jesus is looking for. That's what God's looking for. He's looking for people who want to be with Jesus, who want to share that gospel with other people, who are willing and ready to fight the spiritual battles that are out there. And that's an important aspect of this. Crowds are great, but we're trying to get people to move toward God, to be with Jesus. We're looking for disciples, not just part of a crowd. And that's what Jesus is looking for. So, what's talking about this craziness, the crowds that go on. Jesus has to go off by himself with the disciples. And now the next crazy thing that happens. You're going to be really surprised by this. You don't look like you're anticipating, like you're really excited about it. Everybody should be, never mind, we'll just go ahead and go and we'll see if you get excited about it. In verse 20 it says, "Then Jesus entered a house and again a crowd gathered so that he and his disciples were not even able to eat." So he leaves town, he goes out to the lake, he goes up on the mountainside, he comes back to town, and as soon as he comes back to town, there's the crowds again. And they're so pressed in that they can't eat, they can't sit down to eat. In verse 21 it says, "When his family heard about this, they went to take charge of him, for they said, he is out of his mind." Now the word family in literally is his people. That's what the word means. The implication is that it's his family. We're going to see in a few minutes, it's his mother and his brothers. Now, if you remember this Christmas story and you think of Mary, it's a little bit difficult to kind of see the issue here where why does Mary kind of turn against Jesus? They think he is out of his mind. And by the way, the phrase "take charge of him" doesn't mean well, we're going to be responsible for him now. It means they're going to kidnap him. They're going to grab him and take him someplace so that he's not making a fool of himself anymore. That's their attitude. He's out of his mind. He's crazy. The craziness is happening. Not only are the crowds creating this crazy situation, but Jesus' family is starting to take the attitude that we need to do something about this guy. He's getting out of control. He's out of his mind. He's just completely lost everything. That's not what we're accustomed to thinking about with Jesus, but that's the way that a lot of times it is when people who don't get it, they look at Jesus and they see crazy. They look at you and me and they see crazy. They don't see the rationale behind it. They don't accept the truth of it. They just say, no, those people are just nuts. They think you're nuts. They think I'm nuts. In fact, that's one of the things that somebody has said previously that I think about every now and then is that if people don't think you're crazy, you're probably not following Christ right. Isn't that weird? We tend to think, oh, no, we need to make ourselves look sane and balanced and not look weird at all. But Jesus, that's not what people saw in Jesus. They saw a crazy person. Now, we're going to take a little bit of break from the family just for a second because when we get to the next verse, it kind of changes. In verse 22, it says, "And the teachers of the law who came down from Jerusalem said, 'He is possessed by Beelzebul. By the prince of demons, he is driving out demons.'" His family thinks he's crazy. The teachers of the law think he's demon-possessed. Pretty hard to be a preacher and call disciples to yourself when you got people who, A, think you're crazy, or B, think you're demon-possessed, or probably most people, many people, think you're both. You're demon-possessed and crazy. When Jesus was on earth, a lot of people just didn't see Jesus the way that we would today, way we do when we're sitting there. They saw Jesus as out of control, crazy, maybe possessed by some evil spirit. But this goes back to the idea of fighting those spiritual battles. As followers of Christ, we have to be willing to stand with Jesus, who some people are going to think is crazy, who some people are going to think is demon-possessed. The reality is, Jesus didn't come to earth to be a great moral teacher or to be some religious leader. He came to earth and said, "I am the Son of God. My death on the cross means something for each individual person in this world. You need to be saved from your sins, and my death and resurrection paid that price." And people are going to look at that and say, "No, that's crazy. I think you missed the boat here, and you're starting to go and follow the wrong spirits. You're not following the Holy Spirit, God, because we know what the Holy Spirit says, and Jesus, you're not doing it." And that's what they're saying. Beelzebul, for example, or Beelzebub, depending on what translation you have, it's a little unclear as to what that actually should be translated by, but just translated as the prince of demons. It's another name for Satan, is what it is. So when they say he is possessed by Beelzebul, they're saying he's following Satan. Satan is leading Jesus around. That's what the teachers of the law are saying. And so Jesus has to answer. And notice that we've gone full circle from back a few chapters. People have gone from Jesus being questioned about things to where now he's being accused of things. He's not just simply a bad teacher or this questionable. We've got to do something about these crowds, and so we're going to have to go after Jesus. And that's what they do. This is going to change the way Jesus preaches, by the way. When you come back next week and we look at the next story, you're going to realize that Jesus is going to change the way he speaks to people in general. But I'm not going to tell you what that is. You have to come back next week and find out. In verse 3, Jesus called them over to him and began to speak to them in parables. That's part of the hint for next week. He's going to tell parables. And he says, how can Satan drive out Satan? If a kingdom is divided against itself, that kingdom cannot stand. If a house is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. So the picture then is Jesus saying, well, just think about things for just a second, teachers of the law. You're accusing me of driving out demons. Well, why would Satan be wanting to drive out demons? Wouldn't that create problems for Satan? Isn't the opposite really what God... Now, it is possible Satan is the father of lies, and Satan does do things to trick people and to deceive people. So there is a possibility that Satan could, in some cases, be part of a movement to cast out demons from people. But the reality is that as a tactic, as a strategy, it isn't going to work in the long run. You can't be fighting each other if you want to succeed, if Satan wants to succeed. You're just causing division. And so Jesus says, just think about it for a minute. Why would I be casting out demons by the power of Satan? Wouldn't that be counterproductive for Satan? And the house is the same way. If the house is divided against itself, that house cannot stand. And in verse 26, it says, and if Satan opposes himself and is divided, he cannot stand. His end has come. In fact, no one can enter a strong man's house without first tying him up. Then he can plunder the strong man's house. So the first one is, wouldn't there be a division here? Wouldn't you have really like a civil war going on between these evil spirits? And then Jesus says, and not only that, but if you're going to conquer somebody, first you have to tie that person up, and then you can start doing things against that person. You can start, if you tie up the demons, then you can start battling Satan. Why? Because his ability to do things is going to be limited now. And so Jesus just says, just think about it logically for just a moment, and you realize that this idea that Satan would be the cause of Satan being cast out makes no sense. Of course, the teachers of the law aren't going to listen to that. I've had this little story up here for a while, and I have to use it. It says there was a certain mental patient was convinced that he was dead. So he was committed to the care of a psychiatrist. The psychiatrist had the man read an anatomy book, and watch films to show how dead men do not bleed. Then he took him into a room full of cadavers where the man saw for himself that dead men do not bleed. All right, I'm convinced dead men don't bleed, he said. Then the doctor took a pin and poked the man, and a tiny drop of blood appeared. Well, what do you know? The man responded. Dead men do bleed. That is one of the things that happens to people is that they are convinced something so much that even when you show them exactly the opposite, they still don't believe it. They'll believe because they've already convinced themselves that whatever they believe is true, and you can't change their mind. And that's really what happens to Jesus here. Even though he shows them, this can't be right, they're not going to believe it. They've already decided Jesus must die, therefore he must be doing this by the power of Satan, and right on down the line. They're already convinced. And that's what happens, and that's the part that you have to keep in mind when we read verse 28. It says, truly I tell you, people can be forgiven all their sins and every slander they utter. But whoever blasphemes against the Holy Spirit will never be forgiven. They are guilty of an eternal sin. He said this because they were saying he has an impure spirit. So Jesus says, look, there are some of you that no matter what you hear, no matter what I say, no matter what happens, you've already made up your mind. And therefore, forgiveness is not coming to you. And it's just, and it's because of that. Now, this is a passage that many people over the year have talked about, the unforgivable sin, and what is that? Well, primarily, the unforgivable sin is the refusal to believe that Jesus is God, he is from God, and what he's doing is from the power of God. And we see that these teachers of the law have put themselves in that place. They say Jesus has an impure spirit, and nothing Jesus does or says will change their mind. Previously, we called that hardness of heart or stubborn heart. And that's the way it is. Some people just are not going to believe. You are not going to change their mind, no matter how much you reason with them, no matter how much you show the truth to them. They've already decided that dead men do bleed. And you can't change that. And that's what Jesus says. There's just a certain group of people out there just refuse to believe. So lesson number three is attributing God's work to Satan is something God never takes lightly. I can't say anything else about that. If you've done that in your own heart, God cannot forgive you, cannot bring grace into your life, because you've already made that choice. Verse 31, we're going to come back to Jesus' mother and brother for just a second. It says, then Jesus' mother and brothers arrived, standing outside. Remember earlier we said they think he's crazy, so they came to take charge of him. Well, now they've come, they've arrived. Standing outside, they sent someone in to call him. A crowd was sitting around him, and they told him, your mother and brothers are outside looking for you. Who are my mother and my brothers? Jesus asked. Then he looked at those seated in a circle around him and said, here are my mother and my brothers. Whoever does God's will is my brother and sister and mother. Rules have changed a little bit. The reality is, Jesus says, if you think I'm crazy, you're outside the family that I'm building here. If you think I'm possessed by Satan, you're not part of the group. You're not one of my disciples. If you're going to be stubborn, hard of heart, if you're going to stay in that situation, then you're never going to be a part of my family, my brothers and sisters. You're never going to be part of this relationship. And so the challenge for us as we're going forward is this idea that do I have a fourth lesson? Good, because I have one here too. Choosing to follow Jesus affects every choice we make and every relationship we have. That's part of the whole spiritual warfare idea. There comes a time when you just have to realize that there are those who are putting themselves on the other side, opposed to Jesus. And there are those who are part of the family, who have put their faith in Christ. And that's part of your family. The challenge for us is to live that out in a way that shows that even though there are some who are in opposition, we still treat them with grace, but they're not part of the family. And that can make a difficult situation for us. But Jesus is drawing a line in the sand. He said, yeah, I see my mom out there. I see my brothers. I see my family out there. But they're not the reason why I came, because they're not putting their faith in me. It's one of the reasons why Jesus kind of withdraws from the crowds. It's why he takes his disciples off by themselves. It's why Jesus doesn't try harder, for example, to try to convince the teachers of the law. It's why at next week we're going to see that he's going to not necessarily obscure the message, but he's not going to say it straight out. It's why he kept his demons from saying Son of God, because Jesus realizes that there's two groups of people out there, those who choose to follow Christ and those who don't. And that is the challenge that Jesus faces for the rest of this book. The beginning of the gospel is the life, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus. The end of the gospel is what you decide to do with that information. Let's pray. Father, I ask you to open our eyes, open our minds, open our thoughts to what you are teaching us today. And God, help us to be willing to stand with Jesus regardless of what other people say, what other people think, and where what other people will do to us. God, we need to be confident in you. People thought